this week's 51%, a New York-based Haiti project includes a focus on women. We meet a chef intent on village transformation in Malawi, and a writer tells a post-election story.
He showed his concern and awareness that through it all, every one of us, no matter how we voted, are people who need to be heard and appreciated.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The Poughkeepsie, New York-based Vassar Haiti Project was founded in 2001 and supports the welfare of artists and artisans in Haiti and sustainable development in Chermette, a remote mountain village in the northwestern part of the impoverished Caribbean nation. The Vassar Haiti Project functions through the auction and sale of Haitian art and handcrafts. Contributions are guided by five initiatives: education, medical access, reforestation, water purification, and women's leadership. Lila Mead is founder and co-chair of the Vassar Haiti Project and speaks to the Women's Leadership Initiative.
The women in the village that we support, they're one of the strongest, most vital, alive, strong-spirited people that I've ever met in my life. Many of them have 5 to 10 children. Many of their husbands have left, so they are really the sole parent trying to feed their children in very harsh conditions. They live in small houses. They have no business, quote unquote, so to speak, or no financial income. What the Vassar Haiti Project has started to do about 2 years ago is bring the women together and start bringing ideas to them on ways that they can make crafts, sew things, plant coffee beans, ways of bringing income into their village. And it started with about 70 women. We're not ready for 70 women yet. We're right now about 35 or 40. And they've already started planting, well, I think we've just planted 5,000 coffee trees, which will bring increased financial stability in the area in the next few years. I think it takes 3 or 4 years for coffee beans to really start taking hold, but their coffee is unbelievable. And we've also brought beads and earring pieces and jewelry, making little things to make jewelry. And we've been selling them at our art sale, and they've been very, very popular. So every time we sell a pair of earrings, we give all the money right back to the co-op, and then they were investing in themselves. So it's starting, and it will take us about 5 years to make this really happen. But sometimes you start these things slowly, and then they really take effect.
The women's initiative really had an effect on now sophomore at Vassar College, Alexandra Ng.
When we went there in March, we have a meeting with the women's co-op to make sure that we're best serving their needs and giving them the materials and support that they really need to succeed. So when we go into our meeting, we all gather in a room with a few VHP students and the entire women's co-op, and it is like the most girl power on steroids thing that you've ever seen before. All of the women come in these beautiful outfits, and they all sing these long songs that to show their strength and their vitality and their spirit. It's really amazing. And just seeing how literally the jewelry and the coffee and the napkins all come straight from their hands makes it so much more meaningful when we have them at our sales. I mean, we don't get the privilege to meet every artist that makes the paintings and the handcrafts that we sell, but to know that we know each of the women who makes the jewelry and the coffee and the napkins at our sale makes it so much easier to talk to people about it and also, I guess, show the meaning behind those objects.
Ng is education director for the Vassar Haiti Project.
My job this year as the education director is to keep up to date with the changing needs and the progress of our elementary and secondary schools there. While education started as Vassar Haiti Project's first endeavor, we've now branched out and we have a secondary school. So it's our second year of having a secondary school. And all of our students there, all 17 of them, are all attending on a scholarship that's coordinated by the Vassar Haiti Project. So we're always in need of more donors and sponsors who can commit to having these students attend school, which is such a great, you know, gift.
Stepping back to when she was in high school, Ng recalls visiting Vassar.
VHP was actually one of the reasons that I chose to come to Vassar. It happened that the Vassar Haiti Project was having an art sale the weekend of the Admitted Students Day. So when I came as a senior in high school, I wandered into their sale and I was so impressed by all of the vibrant colors and the music, but I was most impressed by the people in VHP. And so immediately when I joined VHP as a freshman, I was sort of immersed in these really sophisticated students who knew so much about global citizenship and experiential education. And the thing that makes the Vassar Haiti Project so special is that you really get to apply what you learn in classes to the real world.
Hurricane Matthew was a Category 5 hurricane that struck Haiti in early October, leaving behind death and devastation. The hurricane hit the southern part of Haiti the worst. Mead says the weeks leading up to the November 8th presidential election hijacked media attention.
You know, I watch a lot of news, and there's never anything on the television that ever shows what's happening in Haiti or really in any of the other Caribbean countries or even on our own southern coast in the Carolinas. There's very little coverage. So it's really gotten out of the minds of people, but the devastation is still very real for the people there.
The Vassar Haiti Project recently held an art sale in Greenwich, Connecticut, to benefit Hurricane Matthew relief efforts and education projects, with proceeds to support artists and artisans who have lost their homes in the South, as well as those impacted in Chermette. We turn to another impoverished country where women are making a difference, including in education. This week's installment of the 51% segment Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg focuses on village transformation in Malawi. Ufberg interviews Claudia Sansone, respected chef, culinary producer, and member of the culinary elite. Sansone's most coveted humanitarian project is her work with United Village Transformation, a nonprofit she founded in Malawi. With United Village Transformation, known as UVT, Sansone applies a holistic approach to sustaining a village. The work includes developing a pilot village in Malawi that includes creating early childhood and primary education programming and facilities, teaching enhanced agricultural practices, improving water quality and sanitation, offering health and dental care, and working on economic development projects. Sansone says it is women leading the train of change there, and Ufberg asked Sansone why creating United Village Transformation was so important to her.
Well, a brief history. My husband, Rob Hampton, who's a dentist, and I joined some friends in Malawi, which is a landlocked country in Southeast Africa. It's surrounded by Mozambique, Zambia, and Tanzania, so you can get a picture of where it's located. And Rob hand-carried all of the equipment necessary to set up a dental clinic at Dianguluk Hospital, which is in the capital of Lilongwe. It's been a huge success, Sharon, and you can believe it because there's only one dentist for every 720,000 people. Can you imagine? A lot of teeth need to be pulled. So Rob has supplied the clinic since 2010. He trained the staff, and he's taught around 1,000 nursing students at 6 nursing schools, oral hygiene and prevention, with his colleague, Dr. Peter Silcher, who joins him from Montana. So since I don't know one tooth from the next, I ventured out with a social worker who is now an employee to this rural village adjacent to the hospital. I had no clue what I'd be doing or why I was going, but I was led there. And in a country of 17.5 million and a government with like little to no money, this rural village hadn't seen any help, maybe ever. They welcomed me with open arms and sang beautiful songs in perfect harmony, and I fell in love. So after chatting with the villagers, with a translator, because unfortunately I don't speak Chichewa, I suggested a preschool as there was no compulsory education in this village. I brought up planting vegetables instead of just maize, and I wasn't sure how they'd respond to a white woman with blonde hair giving advice, but they welcomed me with open arms. They were eager to get help. So within 2 months, I got an email, and they said the construction had begun on a preschool. I mean, it was a sheer miracle that this happened. And then enter Rebecca and Kevin Govea, our UVT Foundation partners, and in October 2014, we ventured back to Doet Village together, and it was the beginning of our mission with Doet Village. It was a way to give back and with a passion. We've grown our project with love and inspiration, and it's fabulous.
So in Malawi, when you entered this village, you found no compulsory education, you know, as a, you know, someone in the culinary world. I know you had mentioned earlier that you had seen their very poor nutrition, little in the way of what they were growing, lots of needs. I know you've done work with them in terms of teaching them solar cooking. I mean, it seems like there's just been a plethora of work that needed to be done and tons of projects that you started to take on. Tell us about some of the projects that you're doing with the men, women, and children in the village now.
Well, from a rural village with little brick huts straight out of National Geographic, our team was determined to make a difference. And the chiefs had no idea who we were, what we wanted to do, but they were willing and able to move forward. So now they have a preschool, which is a home of 81 students with three trained caregiver teachers, and the little ones are fed every day a fortified porridge so that they have something to feed their brains so they can learn, often the only meal of the day. We bought a bunch of dishes and spoons and bowls and soup for washing their little hands and water containers with a spout for water. And then we got volunteer mothers to prepare the food, and they're delighted to do it because now they're grateful that their children will be able to help eat.
Can you repeat that statistic again that you started with, that you tell me, because it cut out, and I really want you to repeat that statistic about
In 2015, the World Bank designated Malawi as the poorest country in the entire world, and that there are 17.5 million hungry people there. So it's a big project.
You know, as a woman, Claudia, I can see, you know, that this is a very different work than perhaps work that you normally do, writing beautiful cookbooks with celebrity chefs and, you know, doing wonderful television, you know, producing. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about, you know, what that's like as a woman to be involved in a project such as this.
Women normally are nurturers. And when you are surrounded by these teeny little kids, teenagers, adults with no shoes and raggedy shirts, it's so overwhelming because we live out of such an abundance here, and suddenly you're surrounded by people that you can't believe the level of living that they have. And, you know, you just want to take the shirt off your back and give it to them. So we found out about a stove that they can use instead of the traditional three stone fires, and it uses a third less wood, or a third of the wood. So that's a big help because respiration disease is rampant there also. And we planted a children's garden by the school so that the kids can learn about nutrition and gardening and take a responsibility for eating better. And we also planted a big village garden with lots of green vegetables because, Sharon, they only grew maize. I could not believe, I mean, there's what nutrition could they get out of just corn? So we talked to them about planting beans at the base of the corn stalks and all of the different green vegetables, and they were in awe that all of these things they could do. Now, it's not like other farmers don't grow things in other areas. This village is just so behind the times. So now they're growing wonderful vegetables, and the funny thing is, as a result, the ladies are now getting very conscious of a way to earn money and become more sustainable. So they're making hand-stitched bags. We hired somebody to teach them how to make soap. Now they're selling soap. And also they're making washable menstrual pads that can be sold, which is a huge issue in the women's world.
You know, it's so interesting to me that, you know, coming to a village like this that I'm sure is run by all male chiefs, that you somehow have found a way to galvanize and organize the women and give them opportunities to learn how to contribute back in a financial way to their village and to their families, because, you know, we know how important it is once the women organize together how much they give back to their own communities. Are you seeing that in Malawi as well?
Yes. Oh, it's so exciting, Sharon. We actually got permits from the Ministry of Education to build a primary school, which they didn't have. These kids had to walk so far to school, and half of them dropped out because it was a treacherous path. We walked it. It was awful. We said, that's it. We're going to build a school right in the village. In the preschool, we started some after-school programs on women's empowerment topics. And this school holds, like, you know, maybe 80 students. Well, it was jammed. Women came from far and near and sat on the floor. They were so eager to hear and learn. It's just, oh, so inspiring.
Claudia Sansone, thank you so much from United Village Transformation. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California, and she regularly blogs for the Huffington Post. Of course women work successfully in computers and science, and Dr. Al Grauer is an observing member of the Catalina Sky Survey team at the University of Arizona who will prove that point. The team has led the world in discovery of Earth-approaching objects for the past 7 years.
Anyone who thinks women can't do computers and science needs to meet my Catalina Sky Survey teammate, Rose Matheny. On a recent three-night observing run at the 60-inch telescope on Mount Lemmon, Rose took over the world of asteroid hunting when she posted 82 new potentially Earth-approaching objects on the Minor Planet Center's NEO confirmation page. For the next several days, telescopes around the world obtained additional data on Rose's discoveries. When the dust settled, 29 of Rose's discoveries were proved to be Earth-approaching objects. 32 are other asteroids, which don't come near enough our home planet to be interesting, and the rest need more data to figure out what they are. Interestingly, 4 of Rose's discoveries can pass less than half the moon's distance from us. In fact, 2 days after she discovered it, one of them passed about the distance of the communication satellites from our South Pole. Fortunately, they are all less than 60 feet in diameter and pose no threat to the residents of our planet. 2 more of Rose's 29 discoveries are classified as potentially hazardous asteroids. They are no threat to humanity in the foreseeable future. However, they are large enough and come near enough that asteroid hunters will continue to keep careful watch on them. The 32 other asteroids that Rose discovered in her three-night effort all have interesting orbits and may be the objects of further scientific research. Perhaps one day humans will visit one of Rose's asteroid discoveries to use the water and metals they contain to sustain space colonies. For Travelers in the Night, this is Dr. Al Grauer. Go to travelersinthenight.org, program 291, for more information.
Dr. Grauer is a physicist, observational astronomer, and retired professor. We close our show with an essay from writer Dr. Jerry Burns.
The election of 2016 rocked the world. Like many of you, I've been deeply troubled. Emotions of every type are running high everywhere, just as they did all throughout this tortuous election process. Now we're in its aftermath. Some people call it an apocalypse, and others a successful revolution. The chasm that divides the people of this country has widened. Happy or horrified, how do we proceed as a country? How do we keep this nation moving forward? These are some of the questions I've been thinking about, and it's going to take time to answer them, and I'm certain I will change my mind about the details again and again. But I want to tell you about a man, who I will call Martin, who has helped me with one important piece of a many-faceted answer. I only barely know Martin. He's an older man, tall and imposing. Whenever he walks into a room, you notice him because you instantly worry that he'll bump his head when he passes through the doorway. But when he's forlorn, you notice that too, because his body carries sadness with such gravity that his chin digs into his chest and his head does not get high enough to touch the top of the doorway. I met him at a psychiatric institution where my partner, Barry, and I work as healing storytellers. While our typical storytelling work involves performing and teaching at all kinds of events and locations, some of our most important work happens when we conduct groups with psychiatric inpatients. Martin has been in our group many times. This week, Election week was an up week for Martin. When he walked into the room, we didn't worry about his head hitting the doorway. He listened to stories and participated in discussions with a little more focus than he sometimes does. He even laughed. We made note of that in our post-session debrief with our supervisor. Did Martin's meds change? Is he getting ready for discharge? Well, Martin's had an interesting week, is how the supervisor characterized him, and then she proceeded to tell us what happened. Although politics are not a primary therapeutic concern at the hospital, as the election was winding up, the personal tensions that the clients felt about the election had to be addressed. Not only did the staff encourage discussion about people's political views and feelings, but they also tried to facilitate absentee ballots. Many of the patients expressed deep concerns about a Trump presidency. Martin, on the other hand, was a strong and vocal Trump supporter. On the Wednesday morning after the election, the counselors checked in with all the patients in the first group meeting of the day. Tears, sadness, and rage were expressed by many of the people sitting around the table. Then the counselor checked in with Martin. She was surprised to see his chin resting on his chest. "So, Martin, your candidate won. Are you feeling happy today?" Martin raised his head and said, "Well, I suppose I'm happy that my candidate won, but I can't feel excitement or great delight right now. There are other people in this room who feel like this is a terrible thing. How can I be happy when others are suffering so?" His empathy for the patients stunned the supervisor, and his story stunned us. Martin's consideration of the feelings of the other side fostered a connection. His empathy built a bridge across the chasm of the political divide in that room. The other patients and the supervisor were deeply touched. All the feelings in that room were acknowledged that day. None were swept away. And the patients could interact with each other and work well as a group despite their differences. Thanks to Martin. Martin's story is very important by itself, but it's important for another reason, too. People with mental illness are often sidelined in our society. And like members of other marginalized groups, people with mental illness are wise and caring, thoughtful and considerate. They are people. And like Martin, they can be wonderful teachers. Martin's outlook at the dawn of our new political world showed me one way to proceed in these tumultuous times. Like everyone else in the room, Martin had strong opinions. Yet despite his personal opinions, Martin listened to different ones. Because he listened, he knew how much others were hurting. He didn't gloat, he didn't dismiss them or their feelings. Instead, he showed his concern and awareness that through it all, every one of us, no matter how we voted, are people who need to be heard and appreciated. He showed how love can trump hate. After this historic election, we need to talk and shriek about what we think is right. We must fight for justice and stand together. But we can also listen. I've learned from Martin how important it is to listen more deeply. If I listen to others, maybe they will be more likely to listen to me. If I show others that I care enough to listen, maybe they'll care in return. Maybe, through listening, eyes and minds will open. And even if they don't, at least I'm striving to be the change I want to see. Thanks to Martin.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1427.